Sunday, September 15th, in the year of our Lord, 1963. It was a cool, overcast morning in Birmingham, Alabama. Sunday school classes were just ending in the basement of the 50-year-old yellow brick 16th Street Baptist Church. The morning's lesson was The Love That Forgives, the fifth chapter of Matthew. Outside, parents were arriving to collect the children. At 22 minutes past the hour of 10, a force let loose that electrified and shook the world. Great chunks of stone shot out like artillery through parked cars. A metal railing tore from its concrete bed and shot across the street into the window of the social dry cleaning store. Customers in the next door Silver Springs restaurant were knocked to the floor. Inside the church, someone yelled,
"Lie on the floor, everybody, lie on the floor!"
Rafters collapsed. The skylight fell on the pulpit. Part of a stained glass window shattered, obliterating the face of Christ.
"Everybody out! Move out! Out quickly!"
Children stumbled through litter and twisted metal, broken chairs, splintered wooden benches, shredded hymn books and Bibles. Police cars sirened into the block. Workers, barehanded, dug deeper into the rubble and uncovered the bodies of four little girls. The church pastor, the Reverend John Cross, urged the people to go home.
"Please go home. Go home, everybody. The Lord is our shepherd. We shall not want."
"We give them love and we get this."
The Birmingham Police Department's six-wheel riot tank entered the area and cops commenced firing shotguns over the Negroes' heads to rock-throwing retaliation. Young boys started stoning passing cars with white passengers. Police ordered them to stop. One 16-year-old boy ran. A cop killed him with a buckshot blast. Sunday, September 15th, 1963. 19 hurt, 5 dead.
This didn't happen in Nazi Germany, and it didn't happen in South Africa. It happened right here in America, in Birmingham, Alabama. It didn't happen back in the Dark Ages. It happened in 1963, right after the March on Washington. And it wasn't a dream. This was a nightmare. Where were the leaders? Where was America? Where was the government?
Minister Malcolm, who was guilty of the bombing in Birmingham?
The government was guilty. The guilt is upon the United States government for the murder of those four little girls who died in that bombing. The guilt was upon the United States government for those little boys who were shot down right afterward, because it is the failure of the government to do its job that has given the people of that area the feeling that they can brutalize and victimize and murder the Afro-American in cold blood, knowing that nothing will be done about it. The government was guilty. The government still is guilty and will always be guilty until the murderers of those little girls have been brought to justice.
Minister Malcolm, do you feel that the government, as charged being guilty, should inject themselves into this? There seems to be some technicality as to the fact that they can't get into this due to the fact that this is a state as against government opposition, where the legal matter of it is concerned.
Well, it has become impossible for the government in Washington, D.C. to intercede, because if you study the structure of the United States government, you'll find that out of 16 senatorial committees that govern this country, 10 of them are in the hands of the senators who are nothing but Southern segregationists. Out of the 20 congressional committees that govern the country, 12 of them are in the hands of congressmen who are nothing but Southern segregationists. So we can see that the government itself in Washington, D.C. is a segregationist government. And they teach you and me that the South lost the Civil War. But at the same time, when we examine the structure of the government, we find that it is run by white racists, by white supremacists, by segregationists who are called Dixocrats but are actually nothing but Democrats, whose leader is sitting in the White House, who himself is also a former senator from a segregationist racist state known as Texas.
Well, this may be true, but this does not hamper the fact, Minister Malcolm, that there is a legal procedure. Now, in these bombings, and the question is, Who is guilty of them?
They didn't have to worry about a legal procedure when they wanted to send troops into South Vietnam. They didn't worry about legal procedures when they wanted to send their troops into Cuba and tell the Cubans what to do. Uncle Sam has never worried about legality whenever he wanted to send his troops wherever his interests were threatened. But when it comes to protecting the lives of 22 million Afro-Americans, then all of a sudden Uncle Sam becomes very conscious of legality.
Well, isn't it a fact that they did send soldiers into Birmingham, Alabama, and on the perimeter they were held?
I think you'll find that for several weeks when Dr. Martin Luther King and his cohorts were the victims of cattle prods and water hoses and vicious police dogs in Birmingham, they were calling upon Washington, D.C. to come to their rescue. And the only word that they got out of Washington was that no statute had been violated that would allow Washington to intercede, to inject itself into that dispute. But as long as the Negroes in Birmingham, Alabama were being nonviolent and were turning the other cheek, then there was nothing the government in Washington could do about it. As long as the Negroes were the victims of this brutal attack, the government in Washington professed that it could do nothing about it. But on that night, when the Negroes exploded, that Saturday night, and began to react against the whites who had been brutalizing them, then the government in Washington, D.C. sent troops in. And they didn't send troops in to protect the Negroes, because Negroes had been the victims of brutality for several weeks. They sent troops into Birmingham, Alabama, only when the lives and the property of the white racists and segregationists in Alabama were being threatened.
But specifically as regards to the church, the bombing, and the children, of course, which was an atrocity beyond belief, the government, in all fairness, is not able to fight that case in that it happened within the city and its city government, state government.
Well, the government saw fit to send the football coach down to investigate it. And since when do governments send football coaches to investigate atrocities?
Right.
Whenever this same government sees its interest being threatened in Cyprus or threatened in the Congo or threatened in the Middle East, they look for diplomats of international stature.
Right.
But these same diplomats who are sent abroad to settle the differences of other people, if they were sent into Georgia or Alabama or Mississippi, why, they would hang that diplomat on a tree.
Right. Right.
Well, don't you think that Dr. King and all the rest of the very wonderful leaders throughout the state of Alabama, don't you think that they have tried and made sufficient enough effort in the handling of this case?
Well, Dr. King and many of the other wonderful leaders who are in the South and other parts of the country have been doing the best that they could, but their odds against them are so great on the part of the white racists and the white supremacists, and they work in conjunction with many of the white racists here in the North who pose as liberals. So we can see today that it is almost impossible for Dr. King to win. So we're going to need some help on a broader scale from a more powerful source.
What source do you think this particular help is needed from?
As our darker brothers and sisters in Africa and Asia and Latin America awaken and become enlightened and emerge and get their independence and are able to get in positions of power, they look here in America and see the plight of their little darker brother, the 22 million Afro-Americans. And as they see our plight and their sympathy and feeling for us increases, sooner or later, some kind of move has to be made to bring an end to this unjust situation that 22 million Afro-Americans find ourselves confronted by here in the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Ladies and gentlemen, Minister Malcolm X discusses the ballot or bullet.
Mr. Malcolm, what do you mean by the ballot or the bullet?
Well, as our people, the Afro-Americans, become politically mature, they become very much aware of the recent trend in political elections. They see that every time there's an election recently, there's always a recount, that whites are so evenly divided politically that in many areas, the race is so close that they have to count the votes all over again to see who got in office. You had a recount where the governor was concerned in Massachusetts or in Minnesota or in Rhode Island, and the same thing was so close between President Kennedy and Nixon that they had to count the votes all over again. And our people are beginning to see this, and they also realize that any minority group that has a block of votes is able to determine who will be the next mayor or who will be the next governor or who will be the next president or who will be the next congressman or the next senator. And this enables them to see the strategic position that they are in. Also, they realize that it was the black vote that put the present administration in Washington, D.C. It was the black vote here in America that put a Democratic administration in Washington, D.C., and despite the fact that it is admitted by the students of political science that the 22 million Afro-Americans were the ones who put the present administration in power in Washington, D.C., the present administration has put us last. We put them first, but they put us last. And you may say, well, why do I say this? Because they've been down there for 4 years and are only just now getting around to civil rights legislation or doing something about the violation of the civil rights of the 22 million Afro-Americans who put them in power. Now, despite the fact that they claim that they can do nothing about this, when you look at the structure of the senators and the congressmen in Washington, D.C., or the two political parties, we can see where the congressmen are concerned, 257 of them are Democrats, and only 177 of them are Republicans. That means that the Democratic Party controls two-thirds of the House of Representatives, and where the senators are concerned, there are 67 Democratic senators and only 33 Republican senators. It means that the Democratic Party controls two-thirds of the House of Representatives and also controls two-thirds of the Senate. And despite the fact that they control two-thirds of the House and the Senate, and are able to pass all the other type of legislation that comes up, when it comes to the rights of the black people in this country who put them in power, they always have some kind of alibi to give the Negro to try and explain why they have not been able to deliver or keep their promises or the promises that they made when they were running for office. And the alibi that they usually use is they say that the Dixocrats tie things up. Well, there was a time when black people were politically immature that they thought it was the Dixocrats that was keeping the Democrats from fulfilling their promise. But today, as Negroes become politically mature, they can see that a Dixocrat is nothing but a Democrat in disguise. That you've got to be a Democrat before you can be a Dixocrat. And as our people begin to see this, they also are able to see that it is actually a coalition of Southern Democrats along with the Northern Democrats who actually play a giant political con game to make the Negro think that they're actually for us and at the same time, they are not. A good example of this, recently when I was in Washington, D.C., watching the senator's filibuster, I noticed that in the back of the Senate room, there was a huge map on the wall showing the states where most of the Negroes live. And in each one of those states where the majority of the Negroes were living, the senator from that state was involved in a filibuster, which meant that he had the filibuster in order to keep those Negroes from getting voting rights. Because as soon as the Negroes in the southern states get voting rights, they will vote out of office the present racist segregationists who are posing as senators in Washington, D.C. And once the Negro gets the vote and he can oust these southern senators and southern congressmen, then that means the present committees that govern the direction that this government takes in its foreign and domestic policy will be changed because the committee chairman will be changed. And in many instances, they'll have a black senator or a black congressman. The including of black people into the governmental system automatically will mean that the political philosophy of the government will change, the political direction of the government will change, and it will have an effect upon the economy of this particular country. In fact, the 22 million Afro-Americans are in a position to bring about a bloodless revolution where America is concerned, because if America gives complete voting rights and voting power to every person on this continent, it will include overnight a block of 22 million Afro-Americans who have a unique political and economic philosophy. So this means that America, for the first time in history, represents a country that can actually involve itself in a bloodless revolution. All other revolutions in history have been bloody. The Russian Revolution was bloody. The Chinese Revolution was bloody. The French Revolution was bloody. The Cuban Revolution was bloody. Revolutions historically are always bloody. Now, America is in a unique position to involve herself in a bloodless revolution by giving the 22 million Afro-Americans the ballot. And if they don't give the 22 million Afro-Americans the ballot and make possible a bloodless revolution, then they are going to force the Afro-Americans to use the bullet. And it will be a bloody revolution. And this is what I meant when I say the ballot or the bullet. It's the same thing that Patrick Henry meant when he said liberty or death.
Ladies and gentlemen, Minister Malcolm X discusses black nationalism.
Minister Malcolm, since nationalism was able to put approximately
for the five nations of our black brothers in the United Nations. How long do you think it will take to solve the problem of 22 million Afro-Americans economically, politically, socially in America?
Well, it's true. Just as it took nationalism to bring about freedom for our brothers and sisters in Africa and Asia, it'll take the gospel of black nationalism to bring freedom to the 22 million Afro-Americans here in this country. And we who belong to the Muslim Mosque Incorporated, although Islam is our religious philosophy, our political, economic, and social philosophy is black nationalism. And we adopt this philosophy so that we can work with all other leaders and all other organizations in a program that everybody can become involved in and participate in order to eliminate the political, social, and economic evils that afflict our people. Now, the political philosophy of black nationalism only means that the black man should control the politics and the politicians in his own community. And the politicians must also be made to take the responsibility for helping to eliminate the evils that afflict our people in our own community. And the economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that our people need to be re-educated into the importance of controlling the economy of our own community, controlling the economy of the community in which we live. And by controlling the economy of the community in which we live, it means that we have to learn how to own and operate the businesses of our community and develop them into some type of industry that will enable us to create employment for the people of our community so that they won't have to constantly be involved in picketing and boycotting other people in other communities in order to get a job. Also, in line with this economic philosophy of black nationalism, in order for us to control the economy of our own community, we have to learn the importance of spending our money in the community where we live. Anyone who knows the basic principles of economics must be aware of the fact that when you take the money out of the neighborhood in which you live and spend it in an integrated neighborhood, or rather in your effort to integrate, you spend it in a neighborhood where you don't live, the neighborhood in which you spend your money becomes wealthier and wealthier, and the neighborhood out of which you take your money becomes poorer and poorer. And this is one of the reasons why wherever you find Negroes, a slum condition usually develops, or we have to live in the ghetto, because all of our wealth is spent elsewhere. And even when we try and spend the money in the neighborhood where we live, usually because we haven't learned the importance of owning and operating businesses, the businesses of our community are usually also controlled by outsiders. The stores are controlled by people who don't even live in our community. So even when we try and spend our money in the neighborhood where we live, we're spending it with someone who puts it in a basket and takes it out as soon as the sun goes down. So the economic philosophy of black nationalism puts the burden upon the black man of learning how to control his own economy. And the social philosophy of black nationalism means that we have to become socially mature to the point where we will realize the responsibility is upon us to elevate the condition, the standard of our community to a higher level. And we can only do this by working together in harmony and unity to in some way eliminate the evils that are destroying the moral fiber of our community. Evils like drug addiction, drunkenness, illegitimacy that's brought about by loose sexual behavior, fornication, and adultery. And once we eliminate these evils that are so destructive to the moral fiber of our community, the level of our society will be higher, and you'll find that our people will be satisfied to live in our own social circles and enjoy life in our own social circles instead of trying to force our way into the social circles of those who don't want us. So as I said, just as it took nationalism to bring about the independence of our brothers and sisters in Africa and Asia, the goal or the objective of the political, social, and economic philosophy of black nationalism is designed to bring about the complete independence of the black people in this country by making us become consciously involved in controlling our own community. Once we can control our own communities now, then perhaps we will later be able to control our own country, control our own nation, and govern ourselves, and in some way have control over our own destiny. And in order to bring this about, the Muslim Mosque Incorporated is involved not in trying to spread any religion, but to work with people of all other religions. We will work with our people. We don't care if they are Christian or Jew or Muslim or atheist or agnostic, whatever they are. Our desire is to spread the gospel of black nationalism. We want to evangelize the gospel of black nationalism. And once this gospel of black nationalism is spread among our people, it means that those who are in the Baptist church can remain Baptist, but they take the political, economic, and social philosophy of black nationalism. Now, those who are Hebrews, call themselves black Hebrews, they can still practice their religion, but take the social, political, and economic philosophy of black nationalism. And this philosophy in itself will bring about the independent thinking of the black people in this country and eventually lead to the complete physical independence of the black people in this country.